Some things in life are hard to understand. Life is complicated. It's not always easy to understand what's going on. And when that happens, when things don't make sense, it's important to focus on what you do know. That's what's important. Now, I've never been in a battle, an actual battle. But I can imagine that it'd be important in a battle to also pay attention to what you know. You know, things, I'm sure you can get discombobulated in the middle of a battle. And in that case, you want to keep your head. You want to remember your training. You want to remember your mission. So you want to focus on what you know when you get confused. And life's like that. Battles are like that. And the Bible's like that. Sometimes the Bible's confusing. Sometimes there are things in it that are not easy to understand. And when that's the case, you have to keep your head. You have to remember what is important. The most important thing. Focus on that. And what's most important, I think, in this passage is that the battle belongs to the Lord. So this is one of those passages that there's some confusing things in it. And it's brief, and it's about a battle that happens. And so as we go through it, as we make our way through some of these kind of confusing things and try to help each other understand it, we just want to keep that main thing in mind. We want to keep our head on this idea that the battle belongs to the Lord. So same thing goes in our lives. In the middle of chaos, when things seem out of control, we want to make sure that we understand God's in control, God's in charge, and just as he was in charge in this battle, he's in charge in our lives. So that's what we want to focus on. And in this short little section, you have this battle that takes place, and then you have these memorials to the battle. It's very common. We have the same thing in our circumstances. There'll be a battle, and then people will set up some memorials to remember it. And that memorial could be a statue. It could also be a picture. You know, so in the Battle of Iwo Jima, those American soldiers fought to the top of that hill, Mount Suribachi. You can correct my pronunciations. That's what I'm going to say it is. But they got to the top of the hill, and they raised a flag. And the flag was a little small, so they replaced it. And when they were putting the second flag up, somebody snapped a picture of it. And that's now kind of been embedded in a lot of our minds. That picture is a pretty famous picture that kind of became an emblem of the bravery of these men that were fighting in World War II. And so that's really what this battle is supposed to be. It's supposed to be emblematic. It's supposed to be something that Israel looks to and remembers and sees. This is how the battles that we're going to face are supposed to go. And again, it's to remind them as they go through future battles that this battle belongs to the Lord. Now, this battle, it comes out of nowhere. I mean, there's no setup for it. There's no explanation for Amalek, why they're fighting with Israel. Verse 8 just simply says, "Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim." So we have a rule in our house with movies. And I think it's a rule that can apply here. So in our house, when our kids, mostly when they were younger, they would watch a movie with us that we've already seen. And so when something seemed confusing, they'd ask us questions. Well, a lot of times movies tell you the answers to those questions a little bit later. You know, there's a reason why they leave you in the dark when they do. They're telling a story. And so they tell you what you need to know when you need to know it, generally. Unless you're watching maybe a Christopher Nolan movie. For the most part, it tells you what you're supposed to know when you need to know it. And so the same thing's true in literature. If the author or the director, whoever it is, leaves you in the dark, they have a reason for that. And so when we're left in the dark here, we need to trust the biblical authors. If uninspired, normal, everyday people can do that in their literature, then people that were inspired by God can do it too. So when we get dropped into this scene and we don't know really what's going on, we want to just pay attention to what we know. And we don't know a lot about Amalek, but we do know something. If we've been reading the Bible up to this point, Amalek gets mentioned in Esau's genealogy back in Genesis 36:12. So it seems like this is a people group that's actually related to Israel. They're Israel's twin brother, So it's a very related people group. Esau was Jacob or Israel's twin brother. And so just like there was a tenuous relationship between Jacob and Esau, even after the return, if you remember, when Jacob comes back, initially there's a successful reunion. You know, he thinks Esau wants to kill him, and Esau doesn't. But he still keeps his distance. So there's still kind of a tenuous relationship here. And there is a continued throughout Israel's relationship with Amalek, there is this tenuous and even hostile relationship. And there's no explanation for it. It's not like, well, Israel did this, and that's why Amalek is so upset with him. They just attack him. Maybe it was because they just found some water in a very dry area, and Amalek wanted that for themselves. Maybe it was this nurtured bitterness over the covenant blessings that Israel was getting. We don't know why, but whatever the reason was, they attack Israel, and Moses then gives instructions to Joshua for how to address this. Now, this is the first time in the Bible where we hear about Joshua, and there's no explanation for him. It says Joshua, and tells who he is, no genealogy, nothing. And it's probably because he needed no introduction. Those early readers, and we don't need an introduction. Anybody who's familiar with the Bible, you don't need to know who Joshua is because you already know him. You know that he's the one who's going to lead Israel into the promised land. He's the one that's in charge when they have to fight against the Canaanites. And so it makes perfect sense for Moses to turn to him and to give him these instructions. But that also maybe gets us an idea as to why This is being told right now. This is giving Israel some directions for how they could understand what they're about to see and what they're about to learn at Sinai. So God was very deliberate in all the things that happened to Israel before they reached Sinai. I didn't realize that until I started looking at this, started studying this. All the different things that happen to them are preparing them for when they get to Mount Sinai. So God's in charge of what's happened to them. This little attack is not a surprise to him. It's actually part of the plan. So at Mount Sinai, God is going to establish this relationship in a formal way. He's going to make a covenant with this people. And he's been teaching them how they should understand this relationship between him and them. This relationship between God and his people is one that they need to pay attention to his instructions. And the way they need to look at that is not just some nitpicky God who's giving them things to do here or there, but as the one who's providing life for them through those instructions. Those instructions, they are to live by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And so he brings them to a place where they need to look to him for food. And he gives them instructions. And they're to follow those instructions, and they live. And the same thing with water. And so that's preparing them so that they understand when God gives instructions, these aren't just arbitrary things. God is directing them in the way that they should go, in the way that they can live. And the same thing is true here. Many of these instructions at Mount Sinai are assuming the promised land. They're going to assume that they're headed ultimately to the land of Canaan, and they all know that there's people already living there. So you can imagine they get all these rules at Mount Sinai, and therefore the promised land. And they could, in the back of their head, as they would be hearing these rules, they could be thinking, well, what in the world is that going to do? There's people already there. How in the world are we going to take the promised land? So he establishes, before he gives them rules about the promised land, how they're going to then conquer the promised land. And so again, he's putting everything into context. And so Moses, in this incident that happens, he gives Joshua instructions for how to battle Amalek. And he directs Joshua to choose men to fight against Amalek. Now, that need to choose certain people, it's probably because not everybody would have been ready to fight in a battle. It's not like he's establishing this elite force, like everybody's there and we just want to narrow it down to an elite force. He's looking for people. I mean, they just escaped Egypt. They've just been delivered, rather, from Egypt. Their time in Egypt did not prepare them for battle. So Joshua is to comb through this run ragged group of people and look for anyone who could remotely pass for a soldier. And that's what he does. Now, the most important strategy here is not the selection process. This is just a matter-of-fact thing that's happening. He needs to choose men. The most important thing is happening in the next line where it talks about Moses. Moses tells Joshua that he's going to station himself on the top of the hill. The word translated stand, it's often used to describe somebody very deliberately choosing where they're going to stand, putting themselves in a position. So Moses is very deliberate in choosing the top of the hill. This is a place of visibility. It's where soldiers could see him during the battle. So he's not trying to get to a safe place where he's out of the fray and he's not in danger. He's going to a strategic point. So this is where they're going to see him. And then there's two other details that Moses' instructions mention that should be reminiscent for us as we've been reading Exodus. The first is the word tomorrow. I mean, we're kind of geared, if you've been listening to Exodus, you're geared to for your ears to perk up when you hear the word tomorrow. Peter Enns pointed out that throughout Exodus, things happen tomorrow. So Exodus 9:5, Moses tells Pharaoh, tomorrow the Lord will do this thing in the land. Exodus 9:18, behold, about this time, tomorrow I will cause very heavy hail to fall, such as has never been in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. In chapter 10, the Lord warns, for if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your country. And then the second detail here is the staff of God in his hand. I mean, we know that staff's been mentioned, but even that exact wording of the staff of God in his hand, it's very close to Exodus 4:20. And that's when Moses is going to Egypt in order to be God's instrument as he rescues them, redeems them. And Exodus 4:20 says, so Moses took his wife and his son and had them ride on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the staff of God in his hand. So there aren't a lot of explanations in the passage about what's going on to orient us to what's happening. But there are some key words and some key phrases that would tell us that something momentous and something related to the Exodus is about to happen. And so then verse 10 just summarily describes this battle. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek. That's it. That's the details of the battle. But there's something else that receives the attention. It's not the battle that receives the attention. See, in Hebrew storytelling, there's a pattern that the authors follow. This basic pattern. And every time they deviate from that pattern, they're either giving you background material or they're telling you, hey, look at this, focus on this. And that's what happens here, where the emphasis lands on Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. While the battle's happening down below, what's decisive is happening up on the hill. Now, we know who Aaron is, but again, we're introduced to somebody we don't know, Hur. And again, it seems like the readers didn't need an introduction to this person. They're well aware of who he is. For us, as we go a little bit farther into Exodus, you learn that he does seem to be an important person. Later on, when in chapter 24, when Moses is going back up to Mount Sinai, he's leaving for a while, and so he tells the elders, hey, if you have a problem, if you have a dispute that you can't handle, you're going to take it to Aaron, his brother, which makes sense, and also Hur. That's who you now go to. Normally, they would go to Moses, as we're going to see in chapter 18. But because he's going to be gone, they need to go to those two people. So Hur is a significant individual. That's all we can really say. He is in Moses' inner circle. And then verse 11 describes what went on during the battle. This is what we're to pay attention to. It says, whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. And again, the way this is worded in Hebrew, this is describing something that happens repeatedly, whenever this happened. So sometimes Moses was raising his hand, and sometimes he was resting it. And just like with the plagues, we're to understand that it's not just his hand that was raised, the staff is in his hand. And so when the staff is raised, it says Israel prevailed. When the staff was lowered, Amalek prevailed. So that the success is determined by the staff. The staff being raised. That's what determined how the soldiers did. So just as that staff was raised over water and frogs plagued Egypt, and as it was raised toward heaven and hail was sent on Egypt, as it was raised over the land and locust came onto the land, as it was raised over the Red Sea and the waters parted and then raised over the sea again and the waters came crashing down. That same motion is now at work. The power of God is at work. As it's raised over the battle, God's power is demonstrated just as it was in Egypt, only this time it's demonstrated through these people, through the Israelites as they're defeating the enemy. But how would they know that? How would they know that that's what's happening? Well, they're on the hill. They would start to see a pattern. And whenever the staff is lowered, they're losing. Whenever the staff is raised, they're winning. Moses is there. He's in that conspicuous place out in the open so that the soldiers can see him. They need to understand what's happening. They need to understand why they're winning, why they're losing. And so that pattern establishes that. Why were they winning? Why would they win this combat? This hand-to-hand combat, was the power in their hands? No, the power is symbolically displayed in Moses' hand. And really, Moses' hand is one of those things that reflects God's hand. The staff is to point them to God and to say that the same God with the outstretched arm and the mighty hand that delivered them is the one that's going to actually deliver them in this battle through their fighting. So that's the hand that they're to look to. That's how they could win these battles against anyone that set themselves up against the Lord. There is a problem, though. So in verse 12, it gives us a hint, first of all, because it uses the word hands, plural, for the first time. You don't really notice this at first, but earlier it's just one singular hand that's used. But now both hands are necessary. And so, when I envision this, I don't know if you're like me, you envision maybe Moses with two hands with the staff raised sideways, right? Well, he's only holding it with one hand at first. I think he's holding it straight up. I think he's holding it up as high as he can with one hand so that people can see him. That's just, I don't know, but that's what I... He's holding it with one hand, though. And then maybe he switches hands, and then he's, at some point, having to hold up with both hands. Why is he having to do that? No matter how strong you are, right? You hold something up, and it's going to get heavy. And you're not going to be able to do that forever. And so, that is why it says that his hands got heavier. Or he got, his hands grew weary. And again, in verse 12, that's the line that is drawing some attention to it. So that we see, that's a massive problem, right? We've already established when the staff is up, they win. When the staff is down, they lose. If he can't raise that, there's a real problem. So whether they went up for this reason or not, it's at this point that Aaron and Hur step in. They help Moses. He couldn't bear that burden by himself. And so they sit him down on a rock, probably so that they have an easier time helping him. You know, he's lowered, and they can stand next to him. And with their own hands, they make sure that his hands are secure. His hands are steady. So I think this is going to come to play more in chapter 18. But it's good to mention that even and especially in ministry, one man is not enough. I wouldn't say two men are enough either. This is one of those things that points out that, or just reminds us, I guess, that this little model that Baptists invented of having the pastor and anyone else they can afford to hire is not a good model. And it's not a historical model. And it's not a biblical model. The biblical model has a group of men that bear that burden together. Some of them paid, some of them not paid. And so that makes sense, to bear the spiritual burden together, not singularly. So we'll look at that more when we get to chapter 18, but it's good to at least mention here. What we see here in the text, though, is the results of sharing the burden. Earlier in verse 10, it starts with Joshua's action, and then it moves to Moses. Well, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur. Here it goes in the reverse. And what we see in first is that, again, Moses' hands, because of what Aaron and Hur do, his hands are steady. They're, and again, this is emphasized in a way that you might not be able to see, but the Hebrew uses the noun. So John Durham, he translates it this way, that Moses' hands were firmness itself. He goes from being wavering and collapsing under the pressure to being the picture of steadiness, the picture of firmness. It says right through the daylight fighting hours. So this is, first of all, what happens when they work together. They're able to be faithful. They're able to be steady and secure. But then it tells us what happened with Joshua. He's able to defeat Amalek. Says that he defeated him with the sword. It gives a decisive sound to it. And that word overwhelmed, it tells us that he won the battle, but he didn't completely destroy the army. He wins a sufficient victory for Israel to see this is how Israel's to win their battles. This is how a group of untrained, freed slaves can actually defeat a group that was probably used to attacking people. So after the battle, God wanted them to remember this, and so he establishes these memorials. Well, he established one of these memorials, one way to remember this, as they reach Sinai, and then again as they reach the Promised Land, and then Moses adds a memorial of his own. And it's actually Moses' memorial that helps us understand what we're supposed to learn from this this incident. So the Lord directs Moses for the first time in these books to write something down. It's one of five different places where Moses is either told to write something or just writes something down. So in Exodus 24:4, he writes down all the words of the Lord on Mount Sinai. After he goes back up to Mount Sinai, in chapter 34, the Lord tells him, write down everything that he tells him. And then later on in the book of Numbers, we're told that God commanded him to write down all the stages of their journey in the wilderness. And then finally in Deuteronomy 31:9, it says that Moses wrote down the contents of that book and gave it to the priests. So Walt Kaiser pointed out that in response to the repeatedly saying that Moses wrote this down, he points out not too long ago, some Old Testament scholars disbelieved these notices by alleging that writing was not invented until after Moses' day. It has since become apparent from archaeological evidence that men had already been writing in Moses' day for over a millennium and a half. So just another opportunity to see it's always wise to believe the Bible and not to disbelieve it. So likely, I'd say, in God's providence, that's one of the reasons why Moses is raised in Pharaoh's house, learning to read, learning to write, so that God can then use that skill so that he can memorialize this battle, especially for Joshua. And he wanted Joshua to keep this in mind. He's going to be leading the people through similar battles. And if you notice, he doesn't have Joshua read it. Just a little detail. He's to have it read to him. Other people get a benefit from that. But that is something to notice that, yes, it's important to read your Bible on your own, but you also can take in God's word by hearing it. And that's part of what happens on Sundays. You're hearing the word, and that's another way that we take that in. There's this irony in the memorial that God has Moses write down. So he's memorializing that the Lord will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And John McKay explains that blotting something out, this is an image, but it comes from erasing something in a scroll. You use a wet rag and you erase the ink from a scroll. So what he's saying is, look at the opposites here. Moses is to write a memorial. He's to write down a memorial because the Lord is going to erase the memory of Amalek. So write it down, Moses. You're going to need to remember this because I'm about to erase their memory. again, the idea is that Amalek will cease to exist. That this is what God is going to do. Because of what they've done, they're going to no longer be a people. It's only later in the Pentateuch that you find out just how despicable it is what they did. So God's people, they just left their heavy burden in Egypt. They've gone through the wilderness. They've traveled for months. They're weary. They're tired in that dry, tough, difficult climate of the wilderness. Deuteronomy 25, 17 and 18 says, "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt. How he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary and cut off your tail. Those who were lagging behind you. And he did not fear God." So here was the tactic. They went around back to the people that were weak, sick, tired, the older people, the young, and they went after them and attacked them. I mean, it's cowardice and worse than that. And so in light of that, Terrence, he says that the Amalekites are really the embodiment of evil. Pharaoh revisited, a veritable Hitlerian specter, threatening God's creational purposes. So when we understand what happened, we have a tendency to kind of overlook just how bad it is. We think, well, God, wiping them out, that is, I don't think that's right. One, we don't understand exactly what happened, what they've done. We need to take that into mind. But there's more to it than that. Now, I'll get to that in just a second. Let me just say, Joshua was not supposed to do this. He goes on to say in Deuteronomy, "Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you in the land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under the sun. You shall not forget." It's after the conquest that they're supposed to do this. But the point is, don't turn your backs on this group of people. They cannot be trusted. And when it's time for this punishment, you need to be sure to do what God says. So, when it's time, we could say that just like with the Canaanites, they were going to fill up the cup of God's wrath for hundreds of years before the conquest would happen, according to Genesis 15:19. There was a timing to this as well for the Amalekites. There's a timing to when this was going to be important. What we could look forward and recognize is that Saul, when he is given the task of carrying this out with the Amalekites, this is exactly how he fails, and this is what costs him the kingdom. So when God makes a statement like this, the point is you need to pay attention to it. He has a plan for this group of people. Now, I do realize this is a very harsh thing that you read in the Bible. It's one of those things it's a statement that we struggle with reconciling with the many, many places in the Bible that speak of God's love and his mercy, both the New and the Old Testaments. It's replete, really, with those statements. But the Bible is consistent in teaching that there is an end for everyone. That there is a time when we all have to face our Maker and judge. There's a time when all of society is going to come to an end, as we know it. That there is an end to human history. That is what the Bible consistently teaches in both Testaments. That there is a time when there's a stop. And then God is going to address humanity. And so when God says it's over for a society before that time, whether it's Sodom and Gomorrah or the Amalekites, it's over for them. And he has the right as the judge to do that. God is the judge. He's not in the dock. We talked about that last week. He's not on trial. We're not the ones who determine whether God is just or not. God is justice itself. He's the only basis by which we can understand what justice is. His character defines what's right and wrong. So what we can do when we come to a passage like this is have confidence that God is going to deal justly with people, including minors. He's going to deal justly. We can have confidence of that. But the point that's raised here is that God has the right, the divine right, to determine the end. Any group, any person, any society. That this is right, that his wrath is just, And that's what he's determined for the Amalekites. He has a plan for them. And so then Moses does what we saw the patriarchs do in Genesis. He builds an altar and he gives it a name. You know, Jacob, he returns to the promised land after God kept him safe, built an altar, and he named it El Elohe Yisrael. God is the God of Israel. Saw God keep his word, keep his promises as he was leaving the promised land. He made those promises and God kept him. So he built an altar, he worshiped the Lord, he thanked the Lord for his faithfulness. That's what Moses is doing right now, building this altar. And he gives it a name. The name is Yahweh Nisi, or in the older pronunciation, Jehovah Nisi. And this is one of those names you see. If you've ever seen that, like a poster or a list of the different names of God, people like to list those out. This is one of those that gets listed out. Only actually, it's the name of the altar. And it means, the Lord is my banner. We studied Isaiah, and when we went through that, Isaiah brings up the idea of a banner all over the place. A banner is a standard. You know, it's a pole that's got a flag on the top. It's used to signal to an army in ancient warfare, to tell them where to go. So in the battle, when things started to get chaotic, when they weren't sure what to do, they raise a standard and tell you, this is where you go. This is where you rally. This is the direction that you need to go in, so that you can regroup, fight once again as a unit. And so what Moses is saying is that his standard, his banner, is the Lord. Something you look to for hope, something you look to for strength, something that your confidence is in. These soldiers would have looked to that standard and recognized that they weren't the ones that were going to win this battle. They're going to win the battle. It was together. And in the same way, Moses is saying, God is our banner. The Lord is our banner. And very often, when somebody names something, it gets explained with the words, and he said. He named it, and he said, like verse 16 goes on to say. So in Genesis 26, 22, Isaac names a place Rehoboth, and said, for the Lord made room for us. Room is like Rehoboth. Or Pharaoh's daughter, when she names Moses, it says she named him Moses and said, for from the water I drew him. Drew him and Moses are related words. So Moses is doing the same thing here. He's explaining why he just named the altar, the Lord is my banner. Just one problem. One of the words is very unclear about what he says. And so it kind of makes you wonder, why is he talking about a throne all of a sudden? The word is case. It's very similar to the word for throne, but it's not the same word. And so we can understand if this text is saying the throne of the Lord, it makes sense. God's in charge. We can recognize that. But there's another option for this, and that is the scholar from the 17th century thought this could be an error where, just with a slight change, instead of the first letter being a kaf, first letter being one letter, it's another one that happens to match the word banner. So changing it just slightly, like the ESV says in the margin, makes it the banner of the Lord. So I say that just to recognize that I think Moses, in explaining this, when he says a hand on the banner of the Lord, he's pointing to what he just did. He just had a hand on this staff. And that was, he's saying, like a banner. It was pointing the soldiers to God. The banner of the Lord is that staff. Now, when he did that, Moses was showing them where the power came from. And so, just as he raises that standard, he's letting them know the battle belongs to the Lord. And he goes on to explain that even fuller in the second line. He says that this particular memorial, this altar, is reminding them that God is committed to punishing Amalek. That he's going to take care of them from generation to generation. And in those words, it's not, again, he says, actually, I'll just tell you Young's literal translation. It says, war is to Jehovah, with Amalek from generation to generation. So that phrase, war is to Jehovah, is found one other place in the Bible, in 1 Samuel 17:47. And there it's translated, the battle is the Lord's. So these are just some obscure things in a way, but I think that's what Moses is getting at when he makes this, he says, a hand on the banner of the Lord, and then says, the battle is the Lord's. And it's going to be the Lord's against Amalek for any generation on into the future. Now, some of you know what 1 Samuel 17 is all about. 1 Samuel 17. What story is in 1 Samuel 17? With David. Let's see if any of you know it. The story, most famous story of David is Goliath. So David's the one who says this. And it's when he's trying to explain to Goliath how he knows that he's going to win. He tells Goliath, the battle is the Lord's. He says that this is going to be true because it's going to be done so that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. So you go from Saul, who doesn't do what God said, to David, who recognizes this very thing. The battle is the Lord's. Now, when they are in that battle scene there with David and Goliath, did Israel go on to use swords and spears as they chased after the Philistines? Yes. So David's not actually saying, you're not going to use swords and spears as we're not going to use swords and spears in our fight. He's saying it doesn't come down to that. It doesn't come down to swords and spears. The battle is determined by the Lord. It belongs to him, and that's what Moses is saying to the Israelites. His hand is on the banner of the Lord, the staff of God, so he could say with confidence, the battle belongs to God. When it comes to this conflict with Amalek, when it comes to any conflict in the future, to the furthest generation, the battle belongs to the Lord. So, again, for us in life, it can be very discombobulating. And some portions of the text are the same. But there's one thing that we can be sure of. And if this is talking about the throne, we know that God is on the throne, that he's in charge. Why does that matter to us now? Israel is an example for us. Just as they were redeemed from Egypt, and that points us to our redemption in Christ, this battle points us to something in our lives now. The redemption from Egypt, it points to our salvation initially. This is pointing to our ongoing battle. Charles Spurgeon explains this really well. Here's what he said about this. He said, the children of Israel were not under the power of Amalek. They were free men. And so we are not under the power of sin any longer. The yoke of sin has been broken by God's grace from off our necks. And now we have to fight, not as slaves against a master, but as freemen against a foe. Moses never said to the children of Israel while they were in Egypt, go fight with Pharaoh. Not at all. It's God's work to bring us out of Egypt and make us his people. But when we are delivered from bondage, although it's God's work to help us, we must be active in our cause. Now that we are alive from the dead, we must wrestle with principalities and powers and spiritual wickedness if we are to overcome. So the New Testament never, never, never describes any type of religious warfare. There's never a battle that we're called to engage in for Christ in this world, physically. So unlike Islam, we're not told to conquer the nations by force. Jesus made that clear with Peter. Remember, he told him to put his sword away. He made it clear with Pilate. He said, my kingdom is not of this world. He went on to say, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. So there is no Christian jihad. There is no Christian crusade. There's never a call to attack or to conquer people for Christ by force. That is very unchristian. You should not take the Lord's name in vain by conquering in the name of Christ. But that doesn't mean there isn't a battle. So we just want to be very clear about what the battle is, what the application is. Paul said, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Peter goes on to say that our sinful desires wage war against our souls. So we are in a spiritual conflict. We are in a battle. We're engaged in a conflict. Now, the goal of our enemies is not actually to kill us. The goal of those spiritual forces and even the goal of our sinful desires is to drag us to hell. That's the goal. So this gives us some direction for how we fight that battle. When we fight, we are doing work. We are actually making an effort in this battle against sin. But in the end, that effort, we should think about that effort the same way that Paul describes things in Philippians 2. So as we continue to fight against sin, fight against these spiritual forces, the desire to make that effort and the ability to make that effort both come from the Lord. So it really is our effort. We have to do it. We have to fight. But when we accomplish that, when we actually succeed, we look back on that and we realize the desire to do that, the desire to fight, and the success that I had in that fight, that was God. Wasn't me. So that's how we can approach sin. And what we do is just like Moses is pointing to a banner, pointing to a signal that these soldiers would look to, we look to our banner. We look to our standard, the one to whom the battle belongs. We look to the Lord. So unlike Moses, the one greater than Moses has come. He's been lifted up as a banner, an eternal banner. Isaiah 11:10 says, in that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious. That word signal is the same word translated here as banner. Jesus said in John 12:32, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. So our banner has been raised. And it's not coming down. And it is a signal. It's pointing to the nations. And the nations are streaming to Jesus. And that's something that's happening all over the earth right now. Some from every people group is coming to Jesus. Through those that have gone out for the sake of the name. They're there and God is actively at work. And the nations are streaming to this standard. So are you one of them? Do you see this standard, this banner that God has raised, he's lifted up in the middle of this war, in the middle of this fight against sin? This banner has been lifted up, and the question is, have you seen it? Have you been drawn to it? Put your trust in that banner. Put your trust in Christ, and then keep looking to it. Just as God is the one who has to rescue us from our slavery to sin, we cannot do anything to rescue us from that. He does all that work. But just as with Israel, we have to fight now in this ongoing banner or battle. But what this tells us is that we can win. And this tells us that when we're in the middle of the battle, we look to Christ. When we don't look to Christ, when we look to our own strength, that's when we lose. But when we look to Christ, that's when we're equipped. We are just like these Israelites. We're as equipped as newly rescued slaves with no training, going into a battle. We have no hope. We have no prayer on our own. There's no reason to think that your prowess, your ingenuity could ever give you what it takes to actually defeat sin. You don't have what it takes, but he does. And so the battle is in his hands. He's at work in you. That's how you can succeed. You do have to fight, but you can win. And I know sometimes it doesn't seem that way because you failed in the same area. Repeatedly failed, and it seems like I can't win. You have to look at every incident the same way, every experience the same way. When you are going through whatever it is, whatever temptation is, whatever's drawing you away, you look to Christ and realize it's not about me. It's not about my strength. It has nothing to do with the failures in the past. God is going to fight through me. That is how we win. So you can win. But you do have to fight. This is not a let go and let God. God's going to fight for me. He's going to fight through you. That's what we learn from this. So the same God who covered Egypt with locusts and the wilderness with manna, the same God who rained down hail in Egypt and manna in the wilderness, same God who struck the Nile and made the water undrinkable but was struck on the rock and brought water from the dry ground. He is the same God at work in you. So understand, these stories, you know, have to look at them like they're little children's stories. Or maybe we think, well, man, I just wish I was there. I wish I could experience that. You can. The point to these things being memorialized is to recognize that the same exact God who did that amazing thing then is at work in your life doing an amazing thing. There are Amaleks in your life every day. Don't go, I just wish I could have seen that miracle. See the miracle in your own life. That's the point of these stories. The point of the story is not to hear, oh, well, that's really cool that God did that for Israel. It's to understand how God works. And right now, he works through us as we battle sin. And we do that, we approach that from the same standpoint, with our hand on our banner, with our dependence on the one who is able to do it. The battle belongs to him. We're not trusting in ourselves. So look to the banner and get to fighting. Battle sin. It's say no to sin. You can say no. Each and every time, you can say no. Not because of you, but because you're one of the soldiers that your Joshua has chosen. Joshua is the same name translated in the New Testament as Jesus. So you're one of his soldiers. So you're up. Onward. Let's go. And just remember, the battle belongs to the Lord. Join me in prayer. And Father, we are weak. We are easily flustered. We cannot focus on our strength. So help us to see that. Help us to recognize that we are to do our best to make every effort and to depend on you, knowing that we're fallible, knowing that we make mistakes, that we are, again, easily confused. When the chaos comes, when there's things happening that discombobulate us, that we can look to you. You know, we don't have to know everything about how to get out of a situation. We don't have to know everything about what it takes. We just need to look to you and to seek your help. And it may be a long road. It may have many difficult encounters, but we can look to you for strength. So help us to never make excuses for the way that we approach our sin when we are not looking to you. And things are complicated. Life is complicated. There's wisdom that we can gain for how to approach this life, but it all is founded on, it all depends squarely on your strength. Help us to see that. Help us to never make excuses for it. When things are difficult to understand, difficult to realize how to approach. Give us the grace to look to you and to keep going. And thank you for providing others who fight alongside us, who wrestle against these same spiritual forces, who are battling their sin even as we are battling. Thank you for others who can come alongside and strengthen and steady our hands. Give us grace to keep fighting in your strength. And we do ask, again, that anyone here who is approaching life on their own, who's listening to their own ideas about how they should do life, what they should do, instead of listening to you, instead of listening to your directions and what you tell us to do, they've imagined that they know better. Pray that you would help them to see that you, the God who made them, who designed them, knows what is best. That even when it seems counterintuitive, that they would recognize that you are the one who knows the way things work. You can be trusted, and that they would see what you've done through your Son. They would turn from ruling their own life. They would put their trust in your Son. And then follow him by that faith, listening to his instructions and asking for forgiveness when they fail to do that, and continuing to repent and continuing to turn and continuing to follow Christ. Pray that you would change lives this morning, again, by your word and by your Spirit. Amen.